Chapter 14. Revelation and Humiliation. By mid-2004, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald had been pushing ahead to wrap up the leak investigation. Speculation was swirling that Fitzgerald was either seeking an indictment or two, or was just trying to wrap up a complicated, messy investigation. But he needed the help of two reporters to complete his investigation, and had sought their grand jury testimony for the better part of a year. One was Matthew Cooper, a quick-witted, soft-spoken Time magazine White House correspondent. The other was New York Times Washington reporter Judith Miller, who had written extensively about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction based on intelligence from the U.S. government and foreign governments during the lead-up to the invasion. Cooper and Miller refused to tell Fitzgerald what they knew about the leak case. They were holding steadfast to the journalistic credo not to divulge confidential, anonymous sources to anyone, and especially not in a way that might cause them to become known publicly. For Cooper and Miller, this was a fundamental freedom of the press issue. Reporters often depend on anonymous sources to get information that helps hold government officials accountable. If contempt of court rulings were used to force disclosure of such sources, it could inhibit people from talking to reporters at all, making investigative journalism far more difficult in the future. Of course, there was a curious twist to the defense used by Cooper and Miller in this case. By refusing to divulge the names of their sources in the leak case, the two reporters were not protecting courageous whistleblowers revealing government wrongdoing in the public interest. Rather, they were shielding government officials who administration critics believed had used leaks as weapons of partisan warfare. It was hard for some in the public, and especially those critical of the administration, to see this as an act of journalistic courage. In the days of Watergate, crusading newspaper reporters battling for the truth were depicted on movie screens by actors like Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. This episode, however, seemed to confirm for at least some administration critics that reporters were no longer heroic figures, but were now participating in the same partisan warfare they covered. Fitzgerald, who had subpoenaed both reporters early in the investigation, dismissed the freedom of the press defense and said their testimony was crucial to his ability to wrap up his investigation and make a determination whether or not a crime had been committed. He had obtained signed waivers from administration officials that absolved reporters of any previous confidentiality agreements, and he sought a court order compelling their testimony. If Cooper and Miller refused, he said the court should hold them in contempt and send them to jail until they were willing to talk. For Cooper and Miller, the waivers changed nothing, since their sources could have felt forced to sign them in the face of a criminal investigation. This was not, in their view, a voluntary, uncoerced assurance. For Fitzgerald, it was a matter of finding out the truth about possible criminal wrongdoing and what the appeals court would uphold as the government's critical need for their testimony. The issue generated intense media attention as Cooper and Miller dug in their heels. A feeding frenzy ensued outside the federal courthouse building whenever the two reporters appeared. In August 2004, Judge Thomas F. Hogan of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia found both Cooper and Time magazine in contempt of court. Miller suffered a similar blow the following October. Both were fined and ordered to serve jail time. The judge, with Fitzgerald's agreement, stayed the orders until their appeals were exhausted. Miller would ultimately be sentenced to prison for contempt of court. Starting on July 6, 2005, she would spend 85 days of a four-month sentence in jail before finally receiving uncoerced personal assurance from the source she was protecting. It was Scooter Libby, who had told her, according to Miller's later testimony, that Wilson's wife worked at the CIA, though she had never reported the fact. Cooper, after a last-minute voluntary release from confidentiality from his source, Carl Rove, avoided jail time. By July 2005, reports had begun circulating that Rove had spoken with Matt Cooper for the story he'd written about Joe Wilson's mission to Niger. On July 4, 2005, Michael Isikoff, a respected investigative journalist for Newsweek, broke the story that Carl was one of Cooper's sources. He received confirmation from Robert Luskin, Carl's personal attorney. However, Luskin told Isikoff that Carl had neither knowingly disclosed classified information nor told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. Isikoff noted that exactly what passed between Cooper and Rove was unclear. And on Sunday, July 10th, 2005, halfway into the first year of the president's second term and nearly 2 years after Robert Novak's column revealing the identity of Valerie Plame, another critical piece of information that Cooper had previously refused to divulge became public for the first time. I'd heard through the grapevine that Isikoff had another scoop for Newsweek, with specifics about what Carl told Cooper. I remember speculating that more than likely, Cooper had asked him about Wilson's wife, but as Carl had indicated to Claire and me about his call with Novak, he could not confirm anything because he did not know. And the president had told me that he, too, had been personally assured that Carl did not leak the information. Maybe I did not want to believe that Carl had not been completely forthcoming, or that what he had told me and the president was not true. Later that morning, Harriet Myers, a longtime Bush loyalist from Texas who had taken over as White House counsel when Al Gonzalez was confirmed as Attorney General, called me through the White House operator. Like me, Harriet had served in the Bush White House since day one. The West Wing was quiet that day. I'd come in to catch up on work, watch some of the Sunday political shows that were taped, and prepare for the week ahead, free from interruptions. Harriet was calling from her office and said she needed to come and talk to me about something important. She walked in, closed the door behind her, and said, "There's some news that's likely to come out tomorrow about Carl and the leak investigation that may appear to contradict what you said nearly 2 years ago." "I heard," I said, thinking about Isikoff's report, but not taking time to let what she had just said fully sink in. Harriet reiterated to me that we still could not comment on the investigation publicly. In effect, she was forbidding me from talking and setting the record straight about my previous comments. Then, just before she headed out of my office, Harriet said, "You know, Scott, I always feel bad because I feel like I only make your job tougher." "That's okay. It's my job," I said almost reflexively, so as to lessen any angst for a person I really liked. After she left, I wondered about what the article would say and how it would contradict what I had said. Later that day, I learned the truth. Isikoff's article revealed that Carl had spoken with Cooper specifically about Wilson's wife working at the CIA. According to Isikoff, Cooper had written in an email to his boss, Time Washington Bureau Chief Michael Duffy, that Carl had warned him not to get too far out on Wilson. Cooper's email went on to note that Carl said Wilson's trip was not authorized by CIA Director George Tenet. It was, KR said, Wilson's wife, who apparently works at the agency on WMD issues, who authorized the trip. Cooper continued, "Not only the genesis of the trip is flawed and suspect, but so is the report. He, Rove, implied strongly there's still plenty to implicate Iraqi interest in acquiring uranium from Niger." Cooper stated up front in the email that it was confidential and that Rove had only spoken to him on double super secret background for about 2 minutes before he went on vacation, according to Isikoff. The date of the email was Friday morning, July 11th, 2003. 3 days before Novak's column revealing Plame's identity was published. It related to the story Time was working on about Wilson, his trip to Niger, and the White House efforts to discredit him. A War on Wilson, published on July 17, 2003. In his Newsweek article, Isikoff placed his latest bombshell in context. Rove's words on the Plame case have always been carefully chosen. "I didn't know her name, I didn't leak her name," Rove told CNN last year when asked if he had anything to do with the Plame leak. Rove has never publicly acknowledged talking to any reporter about former Ambassador Joseph Wilson and his wife. But last week, his lawyer, Robert Luskin, confirmed to Newsweek that Rove did, and that Rove was the secret source who, at the request of both Cooper's lawyer and the prosecutor, gave Cooper permission to testify. "Nothing in the Cooper email suggests that Rove used Plame's name or knew she was a covert operative," Isikoff wrote. "Nonetheless, it is significant that Rove was speaking to Cooper before Novak's column appeared. In other words, before Plame's identity had been published. Fitzgerald has been looking for evidence that Rove spoke to other reporters as well." According to Isikoff, a source close to Rove said that a fair reading of the email makes clear that the information conveyed was not part of an organized effort to disclose Plame's identity, but was an effort to discourage Time from publishing things that turned out to be false. The most likely source was Luskin, Carl's attorney, since he was quoted in other parts of the article. Reportedly, the source was concerned about being quoted on the record discussing publicly what Carl had testified to privately before the grand jury as part of an investigation that was still underway. Clearly, I had allowed myself to be deceived. In the coming weeks and months, I would discover that the deceit went well beyond Rove.